I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello and welcome to the February Espresso podcast of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm once again joined by Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hello.
But we also have a very special guest. Please welcome Pamela Hutchinson.
Hello, it's really lovely to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. Pamela is a writer, critic, curator, and film historian. She contributes regularly to The Guardian and Sight and Sound. She's written two volumes for the BFI Film Classics, one on Paul and Pressburger's The Red Shoes, one on G.W. Pabst's Pandora's Box, which Julie and Sam talked about in last year's January Espresso. Pamela was a guest at my favourite cinema, the Rex Cinema in Bern, earlier this year, where she gave an introduction to their series, The Lady with the Torch, which focuses on the legendary Columbia Pictures studio and its films from 1929 to 1959. The series was a selection of the larger programme of the same name at the 2024 Locarno Film Festival, and Pamela contributed to the festival publication, which we'll get to later. Pamela, perhaps to begin with, Columbia Pictures, what is it especially modern film audience have to imagine there? Because I think studios, that's something that's quite vague and fuzzy to most film fans, unless they're really into film history. People might have heard of the studio system, but most people wouldn't really know what that means. So can you perhaps tell us a couple of things about that and how Columbia Pictures fits into this?
Yeah, let's talk about the studio system. So we have a system where you have a studio that makes films. So it's not just a physical studio, it's a company with producers and writers and all kinds of people on staff. And in the Hollywood studio system that really got established in the late 20s, 30s and became like the backbone of the Hollywood golden age, you have a few really powerful studios who are able to make films in incredibly efficient ways. They've got the biggest stars, the best writers, the best directors. They're making films that are very popular, but they're making them in very, very efficient ways. And they're ruled by these quite fearsome producers. So when you think of a studio, even to this day, you're thinking about this huge organization with all these people working around who are just, I'm just a director. I'm just on the factory line, like making films. You know, people are writing scripts again and again, and a few producers at the top. And that's kind of like the old fashioned model. The general idea of studios at the moment and contemporary, maybe you were giving directors and writers and stars a bit more of their own creative control. But the classic model from the golden age was this idea that all the power was at the top and all the talent pretty much did what they were told. If you think of Columbia Studios that started out in the 20s, imagine a studio that wants to be run along these lines, but has got zero money, like so little money. Like we're trying to make a studio and all we have is Harry Cohn and his brother Jack at the top who are good at making decisions and have a lot of strong opinions, but they don't have much money. They didn't have a backlog and they never ever bought any cinemas. One of the ways that studios would solidify their power was like they would also buy studios. So they were making films, distributing films and exhibiting films. It's a good way to make money until the monopoly laws came in the 40s and decided to stop that. So Columbia are basically just like a Hollywood studio. They are a Hollywood studio, but they're the cheap version. For a long time, they were considered what we call a poverty row studio, which is to say they were the skint younger brothers of Hollywood, and they were making films and they might make a hit, but basically they're doing everything on very low budgets with very few resources. When you think about the history of Columbia Pictures going forward from that point, it's almost like they never forgot that they were broke and they went about things in that way. So then, you know, it's like if you're really broke when you're a teenager or you're a student, you know, you can still have those habits when you're older and you've got a proper job. That's what Columbia Studios was like. They were always thinking about the bottom line. You know, famously, just to compare, a studio like MGM used to spend a lot of money and get that back because they made these lavish musicals and people really liked them. Like you can speculate to accumulate. That was not the Columbia way.
There are lovely, lovely anecdotes about this poverty row thing. For example, I'm not sure if this is true, actually, but this is a story, is that when they painted the decor for the back pieces for the films, they painted it on both sides to save money. And even very much later on, when Columbia was quite the prestige studio, it is said that Harry Cohn himself sometimes went around to turn off all the lights that were left on in the offices. Stuff like that, exactly as you say, Pamela.
Yeah, and you know, they reused their sets and the decor and the costumes. And a lot of studios do this, but Columbia were very rigorous about doing this. What it actually meant is that when they made their B pictures, which they made an awful lot of, They often had quite an expensive look because they had all the same props and the decor that they had in their more expensive productions. So they found ways to make these penny-pinching ways work for them.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, you said that a lot of their films were B-movies. I'm wondering, does that also mean that there's a certain stylistic consequence coming from this? I mean, you said the films looked more expensive to some extent than they were, but is there also this kind of studio style beyond this?
Well, I mean, you start thinking about what are the cheaper films to make? And so you're going to make films that are set in urban environments, you're going to make films that are set in cities, theatres and gangster films and things like that. You know, you're not going to decide, let's do a sort of lavish period epic, let's do a big musical. So you have that kind of style from that. But then they have things where, you know, you have a particular talent, you have a particular person on contract, and we can talk about the contracts later, but like, and it works. And so they still had a few writers who were quite snappy and funny, and they had Frank Capra, who was making melodramas. But then Frank Capra made, with these clever writers, who made It Happened One Night, which, you know, they borrowed Clark Gable, they borrowed Claudette Colbert, but they had Frank Capra on stuff, and they basically invented screwball comedy. And the same year, they also made 20th Century. Two other big stars, you know, I think this was in the Rex retrospective, John Barrymore and Carole Lombard. And again, you're realizing that, you know, if you're going to pay for writers, which Harry Cohn was always quite happy to pay for writers, and if you can get good stars, you can make these screwball comedies. So you get this kind of like, they basically invented one of the most popular genres of the 30s and 40s. And you will come back to them again and again, especially for as long as Capra was on staff. You're going to find these comedies.
Yeah, and screwball was great for Columbia because you can shoot it on shoestring, right? And it's going to look fabulous. You need a couple of good dresses, a couple of good sets. As you say, the props and the stuff, you can reuse all of that. You put Carole Lombard in it and you're done. Beautiful. It Happened One Night. It was not in the retrospective, by the way, was it?
I don't think it was, at least not in the Rex. I'm not sure, was it in Locarno? Did they show it there?
They showed a lot of things in Locarno. I'm going to get it wrong if I try and be... but it was a big film, like as a turning point for the studio, because it won 5 Oscars or so. Until that point, they weren't getting their films distributed in the same way. You know, once they were making lots of B pictures, but occasional big hits, like It Happened One Night or 20th Century, however it may be, they were able to get all of their films into the cinemas, because you'd say to a cinema, if you want It Happened One Night, you have to take a raft of our B pictures as well. So that sorted out their distribution problems forever, really. And this is what they kept doing. They kept making like more B pictures than everyone else, but the occasional big prestige ones. And it's generally, especially in the Rex retrospective, which is a kind of best of the retrospective, these are the ones that we're thinking about now. We're watching Only Angels Have Wings. We're watching Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. We're not necessarily remembering like a raft of backstage musicals or sort of stories about chorus girls and gangsters that, you know, have their charms, and some of which were in Locarno. But yeah, we are focusing on Jean Arthur and Rita Hayworth and so on. Yeah.
You mentioned Harry Cohn a couple of times. As a studio head, how much was he involved in the creative side of things? I mean, the penny pinching obviously also influences the creative side, but did he also say, tell these kind of stories or have these kind of themes?
I mean, he would say that he was involved in everything, I'm sure. Like, he would say that by being the boss, like, he was involved in a lot of the decisions that were made, but mostly he was involved in, like, finding the right people to make these films. So he found a director... but particularly writers. Writers were the people they treated well. And so he would say, like, you know, you can do what you want, basically. You know, he was very tough on people. And I'm saying that, and that is a euphemism. He was horrible to people, really. But if he found someone who liked their work, he was able to just let them get on with it, you know? If he saw someone who could write stories, he would like, that's going to make money for me. You go ahead and do that. And so Columbia becomes one of the most subversive studios, because he's got a ragtag bunch of leftists and weirdos working for him, making the most subversive films. And he doesn't really care what the message is in the films, as long as it's making money and so on. So, yeah, he's controlling people, but he's controlling the fact that they make lots of money for him.
Yeah, he was addicted to conflict, Cohn. There are a lot of great stories. I think one of my favorites is when he died. Again, this is a story. I'm not sure whether this is apocryphal or not. John Ford was one of the bearers. He carried the coffin. And he was asked, because he was always falling out with Cohn, what are you doing here, right? And John Ford said, I just want to make sure the bastard is dead.
Yeah.
That's a very famous story. But he was a man who made a lot of enemies, had a lot of arguments, but also someone, ironically, who led a studio where there was so much creative freedom and opportunity to find your own voice. I mean, Capra is a massive director, right? And he was just told, he was backed by Cohn. If he said, okay, I want to have the actors without makeup, the actors would be all a tither. What do you mean without makeup? And Cohn would just show up and say, okay, if he wants you to act with your fly open, you just do it, right? Because Capra was one of the greats. Yeah, it's a very interesting human being, Harry Cohn.
Yeah, I mean, he used to say, you know, I don't have ulcers, I give them. And he was not afraid of making people's life really, really difficult. And, you know, he treated women, the stars on his roster particularly, absolutely abysmally. Like, if you were a woman in the Golden Age and you didn't have a horrible story about Harry Cohn chasing you around a desk, then you'd forgotten it, basically. Jean Arthur told her friends she wanted to have him killed, and she wasn't joking. He like, bugged Rita Hayworth's dressing room after she refused to sleep with him. So we're not admiring him. It's interesting to watch how this person who only was thinking about the bottom line could like let so much great stuff happen on his watch. Like, he's not someone you'd ever want to meet, but he knew what he could do and what he couldn't do. And he could run the studio, but he couldn't write stories. So when he found someone who could write stories or direct movies, he let them go for it. And, you know, he didn't put people on long-term contracts as a rule, because those long-term contracts get more expensive as they go along. Which meant that he got people going in and out of the studio and all these different stars, all these different performers, like creating new things, you know, so that F1 has their little Columbia story and their Columbia moment. And, you know, that kept the films fresh in many ways, just because he didn't have that sort of possessive attitude that other studios did, where they thought, we'll keep paying this man more and more money just to make sure they only make films for us. He was, he thought, well, when you come and make money for me, that'll work, and then you can go off and do something else.
We'll definitely come back to the topic of the women later on, because that was also your chapter in the publication for the Locarno Festival. I was just wondering, I mean, you mentioned the subversiveness, and that's definitely also something that I felt when I was watching the films at the Rex. I mean, you've got one film where Cary Grant is basically a union agitator, which is definitely not what you think of usually when you think of Cary Grant. I was wondering, what about, you know, during McCarthyism, was the studio still able to be so subversive? Or did it have to adapt to the kind of the times?
Well, can you imagine a situation in Hollywood where there are some people who are really good at making films who can't get a job? That's a great situation for a penny pincher like Harry Cohn. He's like, well, I'll hire you. Like, great. So, I mean, basically, he didn't really care whether someone was a communist or not. He didn't really care about anything, to be honest. He didn't care who you voted for, like who you slept with. So he had a woman called Eva Ettinger who was like running his little the scenario department. She was very left-wing and she was hiring lots of left-wing people. So he's hiring a lot of the people that were on the blacklist. He's hiring people because he just sees that they're good writers, and they're writing films for him about, say, union agitators, or films that have got messages that you and I might think, you know, are quite clearly against it. But he's like, well, it's a good story. And I mean, really, in a way, he's proved right, because I mean, who cares about a slightly left-leaning message in a Hollywood film that was not bringing down capitalism or democracy, was it? You know, and so he does things like, you know, Fritz Lang is more or less blacklisted, can't get a job in Hollywood, and he hires him. And, you know, we're all very grateful that Fritz Lang got to, like, revive his Hollywood career. He'll do it. He'll give him, like, a year's contract. He'll be stingy about it. But, you know, this didn't matter. So it wasn't that Harry Cohn was, like, trying to be subversive. He just didn't mind that people were, really. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with this studio where you have this horrible man whose attitudes are sort of abhorrent in every way, but the people working for him are much more progressive, and they're just merrily getting away with turning Cary Grant into a Bolshevik for our entertainment. And, you know, looking back on it, it's so delightful.
Definitely. I mean, it's a very, very interesting selection of films. And we'll talk about a bit more about some of the films later on. But let's perhaps move on to The Women of Columbia. As I said, that's the chapter that you wrote for the publication. And you've touched upon some of the kind of stories with Harry Cohn, but also the women. So in which ways does Columbia stand out with respect to the women who contributed to it?
Well, they hired them, you know, and so there were always, so in the silent era, there were a lot of women working in the studio system in Hollywood, you know, quite a lot, and at creative roles. But as the studio system became more like every other big business in Hollywood, as it was dependent on Wall Street money, as it had to look like corporate America, men started getting put in the roles that were important, the hierarchy roles up top, and women didn't get a look in. And this is just the story that happens everywhere. Now, there's a few things at Columbia. One is they didn't have any Wall Street money, so they didn't really have to worry about that. But also, Harry Cohn's out there looking for bargains, and he really doesn't care. Like, if he saw, when he, his approach to women was disgusting, but his approach to a good writer or producer or director was just, I want to hire that person. And then he didn't care. So, for example, in the 1920s, there's this young woman called Dorothy Osner who's working as an editor at Paramount, and she's writing scripts for Harry Cohn on the sly. Just, I mean, she wrote these fantastic scripts. Everything, all the shots were detailed. And she spots an opportunity, and she goes to him and she says, I'm not going to write you any more scripts unless you let me direct. Like, no women are directing at this point in the late 20s. No women are directing the Hollywood studio system. Of course, Harry Cohn is like, to keep these scripts? Absolutely. The kicker is that Dorothy Osner then goes back to her home studio and says, they're going to let me direct. And they're like, we'll keep you. At the risk of having a woman director, we will keep you. So she doesn't go back to Columbia until after he starts making money, after it happened one night. And then, you know, he hires her. She gets to make this radical feminist film called Craig's Wife. She basically bans him from the set, hires a feminist screenwriter, gets her gay best friend to design the sets. And, you know, all the things that Harry Cohn doesn't want to happen, she just does it under his watch. So you have, like, notable people like that. He's constantly having conversations, like, can he get Frances Marion to come and direct some films? You know, they have quite a sweet interaction where, like, she's a screenwriter. He wants her to come and work on some films. She's like, I want to direct. They keep going back and forth with trying to get this project off the ground, and it doesn't. So she returns the check to him. But then he returns the check to her, and they keep posting their check back and forth because both of them just agree. Like, it's quite sweet, really. And it gets to the point where, you know, this is the only studio in the Golden Age who has a female executive producer, Virginia Van Upp. And that's because this woman came in, and she was very talented, and she absolutely saved a project that they couldn't get to work. Had a musical for Rita Hayworth. Turns out it's become one of my favourite, slightly guilty pleasures of all time. It's called Cover Girl. It's Rita Hayworth and Gene Kelly. And if you haven't seen it, next time you're feeling low or you've got the flu, you have to watch Cover Girl. But Virginia Van Upp sort of crafted this persona for Rita Hayworth. So she's involved with Rita. She's involved with Gilda. She comes back to work on all the classic Rita Hayworth films, but also she's making lots of other, like, female-led films there. And, you know, it's incredibly against the grain in Hollywood at that time to hire an executive producer. It put the noses out of joint of all the men that worked there, you know, but he did it because he didn't care. He was like, she's making me money. Again, like Julie, I've got so many stories that may be apocryphal, but some of them are too good not to tell you. So he used to have these awful, like, production lunches where he'd bully all his producers. And at one of those, he announced, I'm hiring a new executive producer, and it's Virginia Van Upp. It's not any of you men. And they were all, like, grumpy about it. And later in the day, he rings up Virginia Van Upp in her office, and he says, of all those 10 men that were there, did any of them pop in to say congratulations? And she said, one of them did. So he fired the other 9. And, you know, they have this horrible relationship. You know, the things he said to her, she actually told him, you know, I'm going to put a clause in my contract against verbal rape. Because of the things you say to me. It stopped him a bit, but, you know, it wasn't very easy for her to work there. But she was making films, and they sort of got through it. The only way to have a relationship, working relationship with Harry Cohn, was to kind of give as good as you got. So there's really notable people like that. And there's also quite a backbone of Columbia. There's a lot of female staff there. You know, we don't know too much about, you know, Eve Ettinger in the scenario department, so many female writers that she hired. But I'm quite obsessed with Hortense Shaw, the publicity woman who was there from the 20s until basically the 60s. And she came back in the 70s. Like, this woman just stayed there working on publicity all the way through the Golden Age. Dr. Strangelove, you know, she goes away to go and work at this, like, edgy company that puts out Bruce Lee films and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and that, but comes back to Columbia when they make a film close to her heart. That woman spent her entire career there, and I'm sort of slowly obsessed with finding out more about Hortense Shaw, the publicity expert. She sounds like she was quite a colourful character, but, yeah, you knew you could get away with stuff if you worked at Columbia. Including being female.
Yeah.
What about actors, actresses? I mean, you've mostly talked now about the writers, the directors, the producers. But if you were a woman and you were acting, how much of a say did you have? Or were you basically really just seen as you're there to be told what to do, and that didn't just refer to film necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, it's not good. Like, being an actor for Harry Cohn, female actor, as I say, he notoriously had a big white casting couch in his office. I don't really need to go into it, but it's repulsive. His attitude towards women was, you know, to size them up immediately. So if you're working for that studio as an actress, you're having a very difficult time, you know, and this is why people wanted to get away from it. When it comes to like crafting your persona, that's where someone like Virginia Rannup came in. You know, Rita Hayworth was, I mean, she's one of my favourite actresses, but she was a very sensitive woman, very low self-esteem. And Virginia Rannup was able to work with her to make sure that she always felt comfortable with what she was doing. She was the barrier between her and Harry Cohn, you know. You have to, like, work with the director, the producer, the writers to sort of get that creative relationship. Even, you know, on the set of something like Craig's Wife, it was very much like, let's ban Harry Cohn from the set, but then let's bring all the actors in and like give them a say. We'll go through the script line by line. It was really at the whim of anyone but Harry Cohn to find a productive, kindly supportive environment for actors. There's absolutely no way to excuse the way that he behaved with his female stars. And it's probably good that he didn't have so many stars on contract, because he took liberties with the ones that were there. And many of my favourite actresses, you know, you've got Gloria Graham, Carole Lombard, in this retrospective. It's wonderful talent that he had.
Yeah, how can he abuse them like that? I mean, these are some of the greatest people, some of the greatest artists in a generation. And he like Claudette Colbert, she was just fat. That's it. It's like, one, no, she's not. And two, really, honestly, this is how you talk to your talent? So weird. Capra was a little bit better, but of course Capra was very eccentric as well in his own way. But Cohn was just terrible.
I mean, there's a terrible thing, you know, like when Cohn started out, the very, very, very beginnings of his film career, there was an idea that like studios or what's called pictures, you'd come and see a film from this studio, from this production company. And it very quickly became, no, actually it was the stars that sold the picture. So everyone wants to go and see a Mary Pickford film, a Gloria Swanson film, you know, and going into, you know, a Cary Grant film or whatever. But the studios are trying to claw back this power, you know, this power dynamic. So behind the scenes, it's almost like they have to, the studio executives, the moguls, have to sort of overexert their power and their influence and act as if these stars who are beloved and have so much soft power, have so much, you know, influence over people in America and all across the world who are selling their pictures for them, act as if they're just, you know, hired help, you know, you're just this person. Oh yeah, I'm just going to shove you into this picture. No, you want to make more of those, you know, do what you're told, or the contract cancellations and things like that. And so, you know, have this across Hollywood, this idea that like the audience think that Rita Hayworth is a goddess and the studio treats her like she's just in the way. And it's not good. It's not good.
It's like this idea that the studio mogul would say, I made you, right? As if it was some sort of weird, perverted Pygmalion syndrome. So, whereas, I mean, these people, the Grahams and Colberts and Lombards, I mean, they made the films they were in. And I'm a particular fan of Lombard because I just adore her.
As you should.
Yeah. And she makes everything she's in. I mean, she's fabulous. And the very idea that somebody like Cohn, of all people, would just say, well, you're there just because of me. It's just weird.
Well, I always think, like, on the set of 20th Century, Howard Hawks has this story that, like, there's this scene, very famous scene, where Carole Lombard has to really kick and fight with John Barrymore because he said all these awful things to her. John Barrymore's character, obviously. And, oh, it wasn't working, so I took her aside and I told her, like, you know, this guy's making you angry. You need to kick at him. You need to do this. And she went out and she did it perfectly. And I'm like, okay, maybe this happened. Maybe this happened. But Carole Lombard, famously one of the most foul-mouthed women in Hollywood, who definitely expressed herself very clearly, who had started out in silent slapstick comedy, you telling me that she had no idea how to play this scene until you just put a few words in her ear?
Uh-huh.
Like, it might be true. And I mean, I'm not here to say that Howard Hawks isn't a great director, because I'm a huge fan. But it's just one of those things where every story that we hear backstage about Hollywood, or have been hearing, is always about how there was this woman who turned up and she looked nice in dresses, but, you know, we made her into this big star.
Right.
Like, Harry Cohn may have changed Rita Hayworth's name, but he did not teach her to dance. You know, he certainly didn't teach her to flutter her eyelashes, because she does that all by herself. And, you know, we need to sometimes like look at these performances and realize how much we can, with our own common sense, attribute to whom. And, you know, Harry Cohn may have made some very wise decisions, but he didn't make Gloria Graham so brilliant in The Big Heat. No one told her to be a funny femme fatale. But she just knew. She knew. She had talent, right? I mean, that's her job.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, it comes off the screen so strongly. And even, you know, at, what is it, 60, 70, 80 years distance, it's just, it still pops. I mean, those performances, obviously great scripts, obviously good stories, but the performances are still amazing. Even if obviously they're of their time, but at the same time, they do definitely have a timeless energy and pizzazz. Now, since the series itself was basically 1929 till 1959, what happened afterwards? Is it just that the other studios caught up to some extent in terms of being more kind of subversive, being more edgy? Or is it just that the film landscape, that Hollywood changed after that? Did Columbia maintain its identity to some extent?
I mean, studios generally had a bit of a downturn. So Harry Cohn dies at the end of the 50s, Jack Cohn dies, and then Harry Cohn dies. And so it's no longer the Cohn show. Columbia has got itself into a relatively strong position because they set up this company called Screen Gems to make TV advertising, which, you know, was a good idea. But what was a better idea was that they started making TV programs, and they made incredibly famous, popular series like The Donna Reed Show and Father Knows Best. And they also were able to sell their movies to TV, which, you know, sort of slightly negates the threat of TV. You're making money off it. It's around this time that the entire studio system disintegrates. They also were in a relatively strong position because they never did buy all those cinemas, so they weren't having to lose that wing of their... So they're not actually in the worst position, but Hollywood is just changing. The studio system is coming to an end. The Hays Code is coming to an end. American films are now competing with European films and British films even, you know. Even British films are good at this point, you know. And so the story of the end of the studio system, it's like a universal disaster, really. Not a universal, that was a bad choice of words, wasn't it? But it's a story that calls across Hollywood. The landscape becomes a lot more different. And so Columbia is still making films, but they're not making them in this studio factory style way. So he's still making great films, like we mentioned Dr. Strangelove and Lilith and things like that. They've still got great talent, but everyone else is quite subversive now. We've got rid of the blacklist. Like, other people are making films that are edgy and violent and aggressive, and the whole world looks very different. And Harry Cohn would probably have been quite horrified to see what's happening as we go into the 70s. The Hollywood Golden Age is like slightly fuzzy to define at each end, but you know it when you see it. And it's when these films are being made at this kind of pace and at this kind of scale and with this kind of control. And it couldn't last forever.
I think this is probably a good point at which you can segue to some of the films, just also for our listeners to highlight which ones they should absolutely seek out. So I don't know, Pamela, do you have one specific one that you would absolutely say people have to watch? Or two or three or four, I mean.
I mean, it's actually a fantastic list. I was looking at the Rex list, and obviously I want to talk for 17 hours about Craig's Wife, but I understand you had a Dorothy Arzner retrospective a year ago. So just imagine that I have told you to watch Craig's Wife with Rosalind Russell. I have to pick one of my favourite films of all time, which is one of my favourite films about Hollywood, which is In a Lonely Place.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are interested in film history like myself, or just, I don't know, something about the allure of that, I'm interested in films about Hollywood. But In a Lonely Place is the best and darkest film about Hollywood in many ways. Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham, he's an alcoholic screenwriter and she's a resting starlet. She's in between roles, and they come together because she gives him an alibi. And we're never going to know for quite a lot of the film whether he deserves this alibi, whether he really did do some terrible, violent act. All these different characters come in and out of the film. There's someone who basically is John Barrymore. And while this film was being made, the director and Gloria Graham, the director Nicholas Ray and Gloria Graham, were in the middle of a messy divorce. It is the saddest film about a romance that's ever been made. And I love it. It will make you look at Hollywood as if human beings were made making films in this system, like people who were bruised by working there. If you want to get a sense of what it might have been like to work for Harry Cohn, look at the way that these people are desperately trying to work and create things, and also they feel so beaten down by the system and they feel they can never get ahead and they can never make the beautiful films that they want to make. This film will break your heart. If you haven't seen it, you are the luckiest person alive because you get to see it for the first time. I would say if you had to watch one film from this retrospective, I would say that's a bad idea. Watch several. But if you had to watch one film, watch In a Lonely Place, directed by Nicholas Ray.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you on that one. I watched it relatively recently only for the first time, but I love how morally ambiguous it is with its characters. And that's something probably like most people of my age, I came to black and white films by seeing them on TV. And then it was usually the more obvious choices, you know, also good films, but basically you'd watch films where it's very clear who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. where you know what you think and what you feel about them. And that basically goes out the window with In a Lonely Place, I feel. I think that Nicholas Ray, from the films I've seen anyway, has so much more nuance and ambiguity in his characters, and that's just amazing to see. I watched, what's his first film? They Live by Night, more or less by accident. That was the first one I saw, I think, of his, where I'd been told about They Drive by Night, which I think has Ida Lupino.
Yes.
And I accidentally ordered They Live by Night, but I still thought, you know, it was a good film to get.
No, I've been known to mix them up very much. So. But they're very different. When They Live by Night, it's kind of like the fugitive criminals on the run kind of, yeah. And maybe a bit more representative of Nicholas Ray's work generally. Yeah, excellent, excellent film.
What about you, Julie? I mean, you also had a look at the list. Do you have any that stand out for you? Any that stand out in particular?
I'm with Pamela. Watch several. But if I have to plump for just one, I'm just going to go with my heart and pick 20th Century. Because I love that movie and I can come back to that again and again and again and always find something new. Big Carol Lombard head, as I previously said. It's a comedy that you have to sit down for. I think if you're not used to the screwball genre, give it a little bit of time. You might not latch onto it at the first go. It might seem a little bit alien to you. It's very dark. It's a bit grim. Stick with it because it's worth it. It's such a great film. The acting is beautiful. The jokes are beautiful, but it has a darkness to it. It has a cynicism to it that almost modernizes it. So the film is about a couple. The woman is an actress and Barrymore is her Svengali. He's a big playwright, producer, theatrical guy, and he makes her persona, or at least he thinks he does. But of course, she's better than he thinks she is, and she makes it in Hollywood, which he thinks is abhorrent because that's not art. That is the movies and the theater is the only thing that really matters. And he loses money, gets desperate, and so on and so forth. I'll not go through the entire plot, but they have a meet not so cute later in the film, where she's already a success and he's desperately looking for her big name to put in one of his productions. Brilliant, brilliant acting. Sit down for it. Have a good glass of wine. Have some popcorn. Have a pot of tea, whatever you want. But sit down for it. Give it some attention. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah, I quote that film quite a lot. If ever anything is, you know when you need to set your boundaries in life. And I say, I close the iron door upon you. I've never said it to anyone's face. But this is the line of the sort of horrible producer-director. And it's so telling that Hollywood can make these films about terrible producer-directors who think that they're molding young women and they aren't. There was already, like, it was well known about Harry Cohn by the time this film was made. You know, there was a Broadway play called, I think, Wonder Boy, about Harry Cohn trying to turn some terrible young man into a handsome, like, Western star or something like that. Like, these stories were already out, the idea that producers thought that they could create stars. And so you make something like 20th Century, which is absolutely set in the theatrical world, but no one's fooled for a second that F1, who's working on that film, knows exactly what kind of world they're satirizing and where the parallels will be. The energy that film finds in this old Svengali story is just astounding. I think it's brilliant. I know it's a bit of a Marmite film. I shouldn't say that. Like, it's a bit of a polarizing film. Like, some people just don't latch onto it at all for the reason that everyone's horrible. But if you like Hollywood, you're very comfortable with the idea that everyone's horrible. You'll dive right in and enjoy it.
I think the range of films just within the ones that the Rex already showed is amazing. And I also think that I said timeless before. Timeless is perhaps one of those kind of words that doesn't mean much because they're obviously these films are of their time. But I have to say they still have a kind of, they are still current in many ways. And I think two of the films I found very fascinating in that respect, especially when watched together, were, you already mentioned it, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, together with something like All the King's Men, where to some extent you have the two sides, the kind of light bottom-up side of populism, but then you've got the darkest, darkest, darkest side of populism, and especially All the King's Men. I mean, watching that in January, February 2025, you have to say that, yeah, some things do not change.
Yeah, it's a really dark film about politics and populism, isn't it? It's really vicious.
Absolutely. And also just about America in some ways, where you have to say that America, even 100 years later, more or less, you have to say that so many of the issues, so many of the dynamics are not so different, it seems. I mentioned the talk of the town earlier when I talked about Cary Grant as a unionist activist. That was the first film that we watched of this series, and I have to say I really loved that. I don't think I've often seen a film of that time that is so open about its queer subtext. I mean, you've got a love triangle, two men, one woman, but it is so clear that the two men are also very much into each other. And there's just the kind of flimsiest element of plausible deniability. I mean, the looks across that courtroom, it's not what I would expect of a film from 1924. And I wonder what the conversations were about it at the time.
I mean, I imagine they were fairly open. I mean, it's interesting, you know, Cary Grant was married, I think, 5 times. And when someone suggested that he was gay, he sued them. Like, he said he did not have that honour or whatever, you know, elegant frame of words. I mean, he lived with Randall Scott for a long time. He lived with Ori Kelly. I think diving into someone's personal life, we'll never know necessarily. But if you look at the films, on screen, Cary Grant is incredibly gay, and he's so wonderful when he's gay.
He is.
And I mean, you know, you can say the same thing about Jean Arthur, absolutely. And I think that film knows that it's skating close to the edge a little bit, so it allows itself to go a little bit further than it. You know, you already have quite a risque setup, the sort of flat sharing and the living together illicitly and the leftist politics. So they go all the way. It's almost like sometimes they forget that people are watching.
Yeah,
I highly recommend that film. And also, just to say, like, boring thing is that, like, if you think you've seen that film before, the restoration that's going around now is a new restoration. There's more in it. Like, if you've seen The Talk of the Town a few years ago and thought it was quite fun, watch it again. There's if you get a chance to see that. And Jean Arthur is just an absolutely undersung legend.
Absolutely. Can I have an honourable mention? Because I wanted to mention The Big Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Because we can't forget that one. I know it's grim. It's really, 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 really grim. But that is a work of, I mean, genius is overused. But it's a great film. And I think it's underseen because everybody's horrible in it, as you rightly say, Pamela. Everybody is a nasty piece of work. Either that or they're completely traumatized beyond comprehension. But it's a great, great film. And I was so happy to see it on the list because I don't think you hear about it a lot in that context, more as the sort of film noir-y type thing. So I wanted to mention that one because I didn't want us to forget about it.
Oh, no. I think, you know, it has the sort of the police procedural element at the end. That's not giving away the plot of the film, but it's a film about, like, corruption and a one cop trying to fight the corruption and they can't do it. And I was working on, like, Fritz Lang earlier this week and I was watching Metropolis and occurs to me that if you want to understand, like, the most popular genre, the crime genre, if you watch M, the film he made in Germany just before he left, and you watch Big Heat together, you're going to have a vision of law and order and justice and mob rule in a way that no other film will get you to that. And the layers of subversion and hidden meaning in both of those films. I mean, The Big Heat is an absolute marvel of the Hollywood studio system. And again, no one else would hire him. Harry Cohn saved him from that. I mean, Fritz Lang was sitting there fuming, I'm not a communist. But, you know, no one would hire him. And this is a guy who might have been difficult to work with, but his heart was in the right place. You know, he co-founded the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, you know? Like, support Fritz Lang, the films are good. And Harry Cohn gave him a chance. And he made a horrible film to say thank you.
And again, as you said, Gloria Graham in this one is wonderful. But if you look at her in this one and in A Lonely Place, it's just the performances are so different. I think, again, for those who don't know the era so well, it's sometimes easy to look at the big stars like Cary Grant and think he's always Cary Grant, which is possibly true to some extent, but not completely. And then you've got the lesser known actors, and the range they have is just stunning at times. I think just those two films and Gloria Graham in them, it's just worth it to watch the two of them just to see what she does with them. I think that's really fantastic.
I was just going to say, because I could talk about Gloria Graham for 7 hours, but I won't. But when people think about, you know, Hollywood stars of this era, you have this image of perfection. Every hair in place, they're standing in their light. Now, Gloria Graham looked amazing. She didn't think she did. That's why she's got, like, cotton wool stuffed in her face and things like that, you know, and her lips overpainted. But she has a way of presenting genuine vulnerability on screen, even within this Hollywood style, which just sort of elevates her appearance in any of these films and makes her so surprising and modern. Even when she's being funny in The Big Heat, she's also then suddenly very vulnerable. And in A Lonely Place, she's the most believable actress because she almost looks like she's not acting, you know. And I think, you know, we see the idea that this is her when she's not at work. This is something real. And I don't know anyone else of the period who had such an ability to convey that. And it makes these films into something special, something that lingers with you for a long, long time.
My last one to highlight is perhaps Murder by Contract, because that was one film I hadn't heard of before. I also, we ended up not seeing it at the cinema, but just because during that time we had about 6-7 films at the cinema per week. We saw it on YouTube, where the film is available in its entirety. I would say it's a B-movie. It hasn't got any of the big stars. It's 50s, but it's so atypical for 50s US cinema, I would say. I've heard it compared to Jean-Pierre Melville with his kind of nihilism. But I think there's also an element of the 70s paranoia that comes in later. And even tonal quirks like what you have in Quentin Tarantino these days. It's, I think, a very modern feeling film. It's about a careerist hitman, basically someone who doesn't come from crime, but he doesn't want to work in a regular job because that would take 20 years to afford the house he wants. It's amoral, but in interesting ways that aren't totally unexpected. It's also the way the story progresses. Obviously, it does end with, you know, the bad guy kind of getting what he deserves, but it doesn't feel moralistic in what it does. It feels more like this is just the logic of the world he works in. I found that one absolutely fascinating. So anyone who finds it difficult to seek out these films, because they're not shown at cinemas that often, some of them are probably not even on DVD, but do check out what they have on YouTube. Although with so many of these films, I would say it was fantastic to be able to see them at the cinema. Because again, if you grew up with black and white films on TV, you're struck by how cinematic they are when you see them on the big screen.
And I think not everybody has an opportunity to see them on the big screen in cinema, but there are so many really good restorations. Buy some physical media, get a beautiful Blu-ray, find the biggest screen you can find and enjoy it that way, because they are worth to be seen really big, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, what you have here with these Columbia films, you have classics. These are films that have endured, but you also have them from the studio that was a little bit off the track. So you have films that were sometimes not that fashionable, and like, God save us from fashionable films. Like, these films have their oddities and yet they've endured. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that they feel so modern and fresh now. I mean, I brought my partner to see The Big Heat and he'd never seen it before. And I was so entirely confident that a person raised on 21st century crime procedurals would enjoy it. And I was right in that instance.
Very good. Do we have anything else that we want to mention? Any movies that we want to point out? Or is it basically just go and seek out all of them?
Check out the list and just, yeah, anything. If you've never seen a Rita Hayworth film, this is your cue to get into the Columbia catalogue and start enjoying Gilda, Lady from Shanghai, everything. You'll never go wrong with a Rita Hayworth picture.
Yeah. And I think because I'm a bit of a history nerd and I like the history of Hollywood, I enjoy talking, especially to you, Pamela, about the history of Hollywood and the stories. But these films really do feel modern. Just go for one, pick one out. As you say, Gilda is a lovely film. It's really, really famous. In a Lonely Place, it's a beautiful film. It Happened One Night. It's adorable. It's an adorable movie. It's a Frank Capra movie. Just plump for one. See it on the biggest screen that you can get to and enjoy them, because they're wonderful all by themselves. We don't even need lots of contextualizing and Harry Cohn being horrible to everybody. You can just see them.
No, enjoy the films and forget about Cohn.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Paola. This was so enjoyable. So thanks a lot for taking your time to talk to us.
It was really lovely to be here. Thanks for your enthusiasm for the Columbia retrospective and for inviting me to come and talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Julie, as always.
Thank you, Matt. And fabulous to have you, Pamela.
And as always, thank you very much to our audience. We will be back within a couple of weeks with more Damn Fine Cups of Culture. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.